what's going on, grandkids? Welcome to a very, very special edition of the Stunt Granny Audio. This is a retrospective of the King of the Ring, an event that used to be held in June for World Wrestling Federation and World Wrestling Entertainment. And I have two people here with me who I am proclaiming, they're not self-proclaimed, I proclaim they are a couple of history buffs. First of all, regular Stunt Granny contributor, Dusty Giebink. What's going on, Dusty?
I met a girl today who once dated Ironsides, but she stood him up.
As long as her name wasn't Demetria.
Oh, the memories. Oh, the torture.
Oh, my goodness. And also with us, irregular contributor to Stunt Granny Audios, in particular, Dan Keister, otherwise known as Zura on various message boards. Dan, how's it going?
Doing great, Eric. Probably don't have the obscure references Dusty does, but glad to be here.
Did you ever date a girl named Demetria?
I can't say that I did. No, that was an experience.
Yes, then you do not share certain experiences of certain Stunt Granny Audio people. Sorry, I hope nobody that shouldn't be listening to this listens to this anywhere in the near future.
Dusty, she is listening somewhere, wherever the hell she is.
Let me know if I need to edit this part out.
Are there Stunt Granny stalkers then? Is that the implication?
There might be Stunt Granny groupies.
Oh, wow. Better.
Very possible.
Better still.
I would like to meet them. run quickly from them. So like I said, this is the month of June that we're recording this, and this is actually about the time of month that WWF or WWE used to hold the King of the Ring tournament. A favorite of, I know Dusty, this is one of your favorites back in the day.
Probably my third favorite of all the pay-per-view spectaculars.
Behind?
Survivor Series and Royal Rumble.
So you like the gimmick pay-per-views?
Yeah. As long as the gimmick, Vince Russo, is good. Okay? All right. I'm glad that's had that time.
Yeah, that's key. That's key to gimmickry. Make sure it's actually worth a shit. Dan, where do you rate the old Kings of Rings on your spectrum of old pay-per-views? Was this a favorite of yours?
Well, yeah, I'd say probably about the same as Dusty. I mean, you always look forward to WrestleMania the most, at least once it started to get pretty good. But it's one of the few that was kind of distinguished and that stood out from the crowd. Probably about equal to SummerSlam, I guess, back in the day. But again, it is a gimmick, but it's a gimmick that makes sense, that elevates someone, hopefully, in a logical way. And it doesn't make you suspend your disbelief or be insulted to watch people competing in a tournament for something tangible above and beyond just, you know, a crown and a scepter or whatever. I mean, at one point it was a signal the way Money in the Bank might be today, that someone potentially getting moved up the card. So it had a very good purpose, in my opinion, you know, and it served its purpose well.
Sure, and we are going to talk about some of the people who were elevated by the King of the Ring tournament, some of the people who may have elevated the King of the Ring tournament itself by way of winning it, and some duds, because there definitely were some duds in the past. The tournament itself actually started as a special event at house shows. Dan, what can you tell us? Do you have any background on that? It was something they did from 1995 through 1991 with a year or two missing here and there. What can you talk
about?
Well,
I mean, and most of this is off the friendly Wikipedia. Apparently, you know, I didn't recall that Don Morocco won the first one in 1985, and they ran these things every year, or give or take, from, as you mentioned, from 85 to 91, and it was kind of a nice thing to do. I think they skipped 1990, but the year that stands out is 1986, because that's the year Harley Race won King of the Ring, and that was in July of 86. Again, I looked all this stuff up, but what struck me as being even more important to me, being from Missouri and, you know, at least as much as I could be a St. Louis Star Wrestling fan is they had that tournament in July, and then in St. Louis, they had the Sam Muchnick Memorial Tournament the following month in August, which was probably a more loaded card. Harley Race won this King of the Ring over Pedro Morales, the actual King of the Ring, and then he won the Sam Muchnick Tournament the following month. They sold out the Kiel Auditorium by beating Ricky Steamboat in the finals and Junkyard Dog in the semifinals. And as I recall, and this is, again, I was still fairly young, wasn't at the card or anything, but I think those matches were really wrestled in a St. Louis style. And at that time, Larry Matisic, who was Sam Muchnick's right-hand man for years and years and years, was working for Vince. And it would be, you know, something along the par of maybe when Jack Buck was around, getting Jack Buck to come and endorse something, or, you know, the owner, the very much loved owner of a local sports franchise to come and present something in the local city. I mean, Sam Muchnick promoted wrestling in St. Louis for the better part of 45 years, I believe, and was in a lot of ways considered to be the person that ran pro wrestling, that ran the NWA, and St. Louis style wrestling always made sense. It was always well booked, and it was a very different style of wrestling than obviously what Vince McMahon promoted. But in order to get Sam Muchnick to endorse this thing, I think they ran very much a traditional card. They sold out the Kiel Auditorium. I noticed that Hulk Hogan and Paul Orndorff were also on that card, and obviously that was a very, very successful feud at the time. But
it was also a WWE-style feud.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know exactly how they promoted that, but I think the matches that Harley wrestled in St. Louis, as I recall kind of hearing about and what I've found out since, were very much wrestled in the St. Louis style. And
how would you describe that?
As a sport. It was promoted as a sport. It was no abuse of announcers, no abuse of the referee, keep the match inside the ring, with very rare exceptions.
It's almost like they could use these principles today.
That would be nice. That would be a novel idea.
Yeah, I might argue that. I mean, when things happened outside of the norm, it was drawn attention to and made special for a long time. But some things just didn't happen. You didn't abuse the referees. You didn't abuse the announcers. If you abused a referee or an announcer in St. Louis wrestling, it would be probably the same way as if, you know, Kobe Bryant decked one of those annoying announcers during the NBA game. He wouldn't play. You know, it was promoted in a very logical, meticulous way that made sense, and I would strongly advise anyone that's interested in that to listen to Larry Matisic's interviews on the 57 Talk website. I think we're not so insecure that we can't promote other people's work.
Oh, we'd gladly. Anything that makes us look good.
Well, and he goes through those booking sheets year after year, and it's just, I mean, the guy has a fantastic records and memory, and if you really want to see it, because every match that's a semi-main event or a main event match on one of those St. Louis cards, he can explain exactly how that led to something later and how people trade wins and losses and did all that. So this isn't the Harley Race retrospective, I realize, but, of course, he became the first King of the Ring, and that was based off of those two tournament wins, and I would say the St. Louis win was more meaningful.
It sounds like, and actually just for historical sake, and I wish I could say accuracy, but it's been a while since I've looked at these. I know I've mentioned them 1,000 times on these audios before, but the Wrestling Museum in Waterloo, Iowa has a scrapbook of that belonged to Lou Fez, and Charlie Fez, I think it was probably donated when Lou Fez was still alive, but anyway, he kept all of his newspaper clippings, and not even his necessarily, any card that was run pretty much between 1942 and 1949 in the St. Louis area got literally 6 days worth of coverage in St. Louis in the sports pages, in all three newspapers, the Post, the Star Times, and the Globe Democrat. So yeah, just goes to the point that you made about wrestling being treated as a sport.
Yeah, and Sam Muchnick could go on to KMOX at any time during a Cardinal game and just talk. You know, I mean, he could sit in there with Jack Buck or whoever. I mean, he was so well liked and respected in St. Louis. And the other thing Mattisic talks about is how efficiently they ran their business, because they knew wrestling had a bad image nationally. They paid all their bills 3 months in advance. They were model, you know, citizens in the community, and wrestlers knew when they went to St. Louis that it was a different ball game, and you also knew you'd be paid well, so people would toe the line and would do what they were asked to do, and they were treated with respect by the fans and the promotion, and it was the capital of wrestling for many, many years, and this was probably the last kind of throwback show, because the St. Louis Wrestling Club had folded. Muchnick retired at the end of 82. Mattisic got out of there in 83, and then he ran opposition, and they kind of held on for a couple years after that, but it wasn't, just kind of a coalition of NWA Kansas City promoters, which didn't promote it in the same style, and then Crockett had bought it by the time they ran this tournament, so I think Muchnick felt like he could, you know, do a favor for Harley Race, and he hadn't signed anything with Jim Crockett, so it wasn't something that he couldn't do.
Why is it that when I hear something about a promoter who paid his bills 3 months in advance, I immediately think of Herb Abrams in the UWF?
Probably because the stories that people tell about Herb and being very much the opposite of that.
Because he left a trail of bills 3 months long everywhere he went.
That's right.
People could learn a lot from Sam Muchnick in a lot of different ways. Let's see, Dan,
well,
you mentioned
it. Me of, real quick.
Yeah.
Like when Lennon sat in during the Monday Night Football game.
Oh, yeah.
Like, hey, come on, you know.
Yeah.
Goddamn right John Lennon can sit in, you know, on the Monday Night Football game. So it's the same kind of power and status.
Yep.
And in today's wrestling, no one even comes close.
It's certainly not in that level of respect in the
community. Yeah, at that level. Mm-hmm.
And KMOX, I mean, that was the nationwide. It wasn't just a St. Louis station. I mean, that was the giant radio station in Midwest. I mean, you guys, I'm sure, can get it up there, at least in Iowa. I don't know about up in Wisconsin. But 1120, if you go out at night and are driving around in your car, the signal's still the same. It's just not what it once was, obviously. Times have changed. But it was a powerful medium, and he could get stuff in the paper, as you mentioned, and it was very much treated with respect there.
Yep. Very good. Very, very important. Very nice to hear. It had to happen sooner or later, and it's happened a long time ago. Let's see, and Dan, you mentioned that Don Morocco won the first tournament, and yeah, these were held in July. Well, let's see, the first two were held in July of 85 and 86. Harley Race won the second one. Boy, these were littered with jobbers all up and down the cards. This Les Thornton character, who I'm assuming was one of the leftovers from Stampede, if I read his Wikipedia page correctly.
That sounds right.
Let's see, as we keep scrolling down, 86 wasn't much better. No offense to Dan Spivey, whose character, Waylon Mercy, actually took up some real estate on our Stunt Granny banner here recently.
Yes, that was in tribute to Dusty's very well-researched quote.
I almost got it perfect. I blew it at the end because he says nice picnic, not a nice time.
No.
But oh well, whatever.
I have a feeling Dan Spivey went down to the public library because he doesn't have his own internet, listened to the show, and got pissed off at you and emailed you to tell you that you messed up.
If that happened, you'll never know, my friend.
Okay.
I don't care what the hell.
There you go. I'm just kind of looking at the timelines of these Kings of the Rings, though. The King of the Ring Harley Race one was in July of 86. The following one was held in September of 87. And Dusty, I'm going to throw this one at you because it happened again later on. It looks like they might have spaced these King of the Ring tournaments out based upon the success of the, how do I want to say this, the wrestler using the King moniker as his, I guess, character and angle. I mean, they extended Harley Race's reign as King for a while. And then Randy Savage, when he won the King, the crown from Hacksaw Jim Duggan, and they didn't hold a tournament in 1990. I guess, how does that speak to I don't know, the importance of the King's Crown for those wrestlers and for the angles at the time.
Yeah, they almost treated it like another title, maybe like just one step below the Intercontinental title, maybe. Maybe above it. Because Savage was definitely treated like a main eventer at any time when he was the Macho King. Yeah, it was right around the Zeus time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it would have been Zeus among, let's see, and he held it all the way up until the, I swear it seemed like he hardly ever wrestled during the time that he was actually the Macho King.
I swear to God, he must have been injured or something.
Something, because, let's see, Survivor Series 90, he didn't wrestle, he cut a promo.
Didn't wrestle.
Royal Rumble 91, didn't take part in the Royal Rumble.
Yep.
Nonetheless, he was the king. And yeah, I feel like he's one of those guys that, especially as a kid watching wrestling then, made that crown important to where when they brought it back in 93 and put it on pay-per-view, I'm like, oh, wow, this is that thing that Macho Man did, you know?
Yeah.
Well, he was established at that point, too. I mean, they tried to use the King moniker, I think, in a way to, they would say, pay tribute to Harley Race, and he would say that today, but I'd say kind of to mock the fact that he was longtime NWA champion. But with Macho Man, I mean, he'd already been pretty successful, obviously, by the time he became the King. So that...
Right.
I think that's more of what it was. Like, it added credibility that he was the king, I mean, more than maybe the title itself. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Oh, no, absolutely. It's almost like what they did with the Intercontinental title back then, too, where they would put it on somebody that they knew was qualified to wear a belt, maybe carry, like, the B-show main event, something like that, as opposed to in future years where they would just throw the king's crown on somebody like a Billy Gunn, you know? Kind of an afterthought. No, we will definitely get to 1999 in due time, my friend. Let's see. Other winners of the King of the Ring. And actually, I don't know if it's worth mentioning this, so I'm going to mention it anyway, and you all can decide if it was worth it or not. But the first two tournaments were held in Foxborough, Massachusetts. The following three were held in Providence, Rhode Island. I don't know if either of you have any, or actually four, the next four were held in Providence. Any insight as to why those particular towns were they being rewarded for loyalty and attendance, or, I mean, it was just kind of like the time of year they went there?
Could be wrong, but I think it drew pretty well in Providence. And so, isn't broke, don't fix it, I guess, but maybe Dusty has more insight than I do on that.
No, just as far as I understand, it was just because it was a locale that they kept going back to, and they drew a good crowd every time for it. And, Vince doesn't like to break tradition if at all possible, you know?
Yep.
Because he held the WrestleMania at the same place 2 years in a row, you know?
Right.
And that was broke.
Yeah, and he didn't fix that either. He was paid handsomely for it.
I was
going to
say, he got paid for that, though. That was also based on maybe not the house, but on the on the comps that were given out and the payment by
right.
Trump.
Yep.
Yeah, Trump had the money to throw around. Yeah, and I don't know, I see Providence, Rhode Island, and I think immediately of, like, Iron Sheik talking about Boston, Massachusetts, Providence, Rhode Island, our intelligent America. So, yeah, this was, like, the around the horn for WWF for the longest time, these Northeast towns. So, yeah, they probably were rewarding the loyalty of these towns by giving them a special house show.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know what more there is to say about the pre-pay-per-view tournaments. I see... the Duke of Dorchester, Pete Doherty's name in the King of the Ring 91. Christ, I thought that guy had washed up on the shore a couple years earlier than that.
Yeah, really?
Holy cow.
Well, I guess the one story, since we spent all the time looking it up in the book and researching it to tell, would be the lack of ability for WWF to legally promote at least Harley Race, and then anyone, I guess, after that point as the King of Wrestling within the state of Tennessee, because Jerry Lawler got an injunction against that. And I think you found some of the exact quotes of that, Eric, but I always found that to be interesting, and I think he had a case. I mean, if you're promoting the King of Wrestling in Tennessee, there's some false advertising there in the 80s at least.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Dan mentioned this in an email to the two of us earlier today and said that it was in Jerry Lawler's book, which I own, but I don't have here at the house. so I promise I'm not being a mooch when I look this up on Google Books. But I'll read you this paragraph as far as I can get through it on Google Books. From Jerry the King Lawler's book, It's Good to Be the King Sometimes, and for those of you who do own it, it's on page 248. Read silently while I read aloud. I actually sued Vince McMahon one time. They were going to run some shows in Memphis and Nashville. Then they went out and got Harley Race, who had been a world champion, and put a crown and robe on him and called him the King Harley Race. When they came to Memphis and Nashville, they advertised events with the King without mentioning his name. Well, I'd been the King around those parts for years. If someone saw a sign advertising World Wrestling Federation wrestling with the King, they'd probably assume I was involved. So I sued. It never went to court, but I won out. It got pretty heavy. In Nashville, the sheriff went down and held up the entire, and I'm assuming it's promotion. That's where it cuts off, but then there's a little snippet of a quote later where Lawler says Vince every once in a while reminds him that he owes him one for that lawsuit.
Yeah.
No, I think that's some interesting backstory. So maybe someone can finish the quote in the forum or something. I don't have the book myself, but I'd heard of that a few times, so I thought it was worth mentioning.
I do kind of want to reread the book, even though it's a little bit cheesily written in that Jerry Lawler WWF style, but it's still a fun read with a lot of cool stories. I really should probably grab it back from my pile of books elsewhere. Let's see. So yeah, that's in a nutshell Special Delivery Jones. Yeah, they might have been interesting live and in person, but they look kind of rancid on paper anyway.
Now, a lot of these terrible guys were substitutes, although I don't think SD Jones was. But you know, a lot of the guys that are just at the very lowest low end were substitutes for someone that was out, but not SDJ. He won a match here, it looks like.
Yeah, it looks like it. Against Sika, of all people, and then was squashed by King Kong Bundy. Let's see, and I don't know, they gave Ted DiBiase the tournament win in 1988. They didn't follow through with it on television, but he did beat Randy Savage in those tournament finals. It might have been by countout, I'm not sure. Or it might not have been. But anyway, so that's a reversal of finals of the WrestleMania 4 tournament. It was a count-out?
Yeah.
It was a count-out victory, yes.
Okay, gotcha. Oh, yeah, 1989, Tito Santana, I suppose, for years of loyalty himself. Got a bone thrown at him.
I like that. I'm looking at his
Wikipedia.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you. Thank you for reminding me of that. Dusty and I harp on this all the time, Dan. I don't know if we've ever done it on the audio or not. Tito Santana and Rick Martel, Strike Force, 1988-1989, tag team champions, have a violent breakup at WrestleMania 5. They feud for a year, and I swear to God, never once on TV do you ever see babyface Tito Santana pin the heel Rick Martel.
Never.
The one time he does it is on a goddamn house show at the King of the Ring in the finals of the tournament.
Well, they threw him a bone, I suppose.
Yeah.
In fairness, they were moving Tito down and Martel up. So I know it's booking 101 to put the baby face over, but this was more of the model had more of a future than, I don't know what Tito Santana, the Matador, what was he after that?
A few years later. Yep.
I think they ran him off and then brought him back as a Matador. So I guess they were jobbing him out a little bit.
Yeah, yep. Before the Matador.
One night in Providence.
He was just the veteran with the mullet for a while was all he was.
No, but Vince still had a hard-on for him during commentary. Do you remember the 1990 Intercontinental Title Tournament?
Mm-hmm.
Every single match in that tournament, Vince is like, I bet Tito's going to win. Well, I don't.
I have a sneaking suspicion he won't, since he's basically a jobber to the stars these days.
Right.
I was just looking at this, and it's probably not worth very much, but this is kind of clever. And this is I'm honestly just found this on Wikipedia, so I don't have any real saying. But Ted DiBiase gets to the finals of a Ron Bass because he paid him off to fake an injury.
There you go.
That's pretty good. I like that.
Nice.
Yeah. There seem to be some shenanigans in these early tournaments. Lots of double disqualifications, double countouts. I suppose, I mean, at a house show, you've got 16 guys, and it doesn't say really on the ProWrestlingHistory.com page or... it does say, okay, on the Wikipedia page that there are some other matches like Hulk Hogan versus Nikolai Volkoff in 85. But, you know, it's your standard roster of wrestlers for house shows, but you're asking these guys to wrestle three or four times a night. So I guess it makes sense that you have a few double disqualifications, draws, whatever, so some of these guys wouldn't have to wrestle too many times.
Yeah. And you don't want the show to go 4.5 hours either.
God, no.
Right.
No.
Because by about hour three, people would rather see their mom get strapped to the chair than a wrestling match.
Then another Ron Bass versus Barbarian match.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Who made the Final Four? God damn.
Unbelievable. All right. Well, should we move on to the pay-per-view tournaments?
I think that's probably what most people think of when they hear King of the Ring, and we've
been
a while. So, yeah, I'd say so.
I think you're right. We can focus mostly on the actual tournaments themselves. To me, those were the draw of the pay-per-view. Dusty, I know that the King of the Ring pay-per-views get a bad rap for not drawing well. If that's the case, let's say that's the case, what would you attribute that to? And sub-question, what interested you about these pay-per-views?
I think kind of it's the same answer for both. It's like unpredictable. People want to know what matches they're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
Before they spend their money on it. But I kind of like watching the thing develop over time, you know, and having a little mystery to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, mystify me a little bit.
Right.
Show me something different. Give me some different matches. But it's kind of hard to sell the casual fan, maybe.
Yeah, exactly, without being able to advertise more than, let's say, in 1993, you had... You knew that you'd see Hulk Hogan versus Yokozuna as your main event.
Yeah, and that was about it. And then you had
nice
names.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had other secondary matches like Shawn Michaels versus Crush before either one of them could ever be considered a draw. Dan, what do you think of a tactic like this? I mean, was it a smart move by WWF at the time to put this tournament on pay-per-view? Were they kind of grasping at straws? I know WCW at the time, they were on the verge of doing monthly pay-per-views. This might have been an answer to that, I guess. Just was this a smart idea on their part?
Right. I'm trying to think if this was when the In Your House pay-per-view started.
Two years later.
That's what I was going to say. It seemed like early 95 they started the In Your House pay-per-views.
Yep.
So these were still kind of a big deal, but again, I guess... my answer to that would be, you know, this is what the problem with WWF, WWE is today. They look at, well, what can we get for this month's pay-per-view that's going to draw the most buys this month? And to me, if you book the King of the Ring properly, it may not have the same cachet as a Royal Rumble or something, but you're going to put somebody in a better spot than they were before that tournament. And they're going to draw 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months down the road. And eventually, if you book this well, which they did for a while, and then it kind of went to shit, you're going to build up enough goodwill with your audience that I think people will buy the event. So, yes, there's some drawbacks and there's some uncertainty, but I'd say it's worth it for that reason.
Sure. In this era, then, I'll start with Dan since you mentioned it, and then I want to ask Dusty, too. In this era of these gimmicky pay-per-views today, is the King of the Ring something that could be brought back in that case? And, I mean, I can go a million directions with this question. People bitch that the shows today, like the Money in the Bank one coming up here, I think next month, you know, they're not being organically booked.
Yeah.
You know, you can't say 2 months in advance, here are 8 guys with a real beef, a real legitimate claim to the number one contendership, so let's put them in a Money in the Bank. It's not feasible to do that anymore because you have to advertise these shows so far in advance, make the posters, make the T-shirts, et cetera. And I guess it goes back to that question of can a pay-per-view based upon a tournament draw, is this something that you think could be brought back on a pay-per-view basis, Dan?
Yes, I think it should be. And because it doesn't have to be something that develops organically. you don't have to put – you can have all these guys, especially – you could make King of the Ring, they're going to get a title match at X if you want to do it that way. You know, you'll get a title match at this pay-per-view if you win King of the Ring, if that's something you need to add. But it's much less put on than, you know, Fatal 4-Way or Money in the Bank or the Submission pay-per-view or whatever the hell else they're running. I mean, it's just – you know, this one is pretty easy to put out there and have it be everybody has a logical motivation. So I'd say it's a lot better than some of these ones they're coming up with.
Dusty?
You took the words right out of my mouth. Not forced, you know? Naming the pay-per-view after one match is the most idiotic thing I think I've ever seen, basically. Yeah, this is I love tournaments, and I think if you say, hey, you get a title shot if you win this tournament, then you got eight guys who are going to try to kill each other to win it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it makes perfect sense to go with it again.
Sure. And there's nothing wrong with, take TNA, and they've got a top 10 rankings, for example. I know their X Division champion, generally speaking, is not or will not be in the top 10 rankings because TNA has their heads up their asses. But, you know, maybe the, I don't know, let's say their champion obviously can't be in the tournament. Let's say the secondary champion can't be in the tournament. He's going to defend his belt against Crush or whatever.
Yeah.
It's not that hard. It's not that far reaching to think we're going to take the top eight of these top 10 contenders. We're going to put them in an 8-man tournament. Feed them in order of the way they're ranked in the top 10. So yeah, in that way, you don't have to book your way into the tournament.
Right.
You know, you could adjust for heel face matchups. You know, 1-8 and 2-7, and one's a baby face, one's a heel, whatever. And you could have some shenanigans here and there where the guy at number 10 is really trying to like scratch and claw his way up to number 8 so he can be in the tournament. But there are certainly feasible ways to do this. They don't have to be contrived. Like, you know, just picking four guys to be in a Fatal 4-Way or five guys in the case of SmackDown since Undertaker was hurt and the guy who lost his qualifying match all of a sudden is booked in the match. Yeah, makes a lot of sense, guys.
And Eric, just quickly, I know we're already taking a lot of time, but you talked about one of the booking irregularities that's always annoyed me is a secondary champion almost never gets a chance at the world title.
Yes.
It seems like, oh, well, I won this belt, and now I've kind of precluded myself from getting to the top of the mountain. I know why they do it, because they're trying to elevate the next person in, but, you know, a little bit more like they had, okay, Ultimate Warrior's the Intercontinental Champion, he's going to get a shot at the world title. That every so often, that wouldn't be a bad story to tell either.
Oh, yeah, and more than just throwaway matches on Raw, because the occasions where that has happened, it happens on Raw. It's usually some jobber that holds the Intercontinental title belt at the time and then gets squashed by the world champion on free TV. So
pretty
much
I didn't
never
remember them doing that. So there you
go. I mean, it might happen once a year, once every 18 months or so. It's not a frequent occasion, but when it does happen, it's usually treated as a joke.
Just my little mini rant. Not really a rant, but my little thing.
It's not like when Lex Luger was the United States champion and wrestled Ric Flair. I think it was on the Clash of the Champions in 90, you know?
Yeah, he became the he was U.S. champion when Sting was injured, right, and got title shot after title shot. Am I right in that?
I think. Yeah, Sting was injured that last half of 90. Which would have put Luger in line for his title shots. what a chump. Hey, speaking of Lex Luger, though, hey, let's transition into the 1993 tournament. I just want to go over the field of competition here. Bret Hart beat Razor Ramon to advance in the first round. Mr. Perfect beat Mr. Hughes in a battle of the Misters, really the only reason I can think of putting Mr. Hughes in the tournament at all. Bam Bam Bigelow beat Hacksaw Jimothy Duggan. And, of course, yet another draw. Tatanka drew Lex Luger in a 15-minute time limit draw. Dusty, what did you think of this field of competition here?
Yeah, now you said Lex Luger, what a chump, but I always thought he was an awesome heel. Just an awesome heel with his – it was kind of a subtle thing, you know, but he was very good at, like – well, here's a specific example. during his qualifying match against Backlund. He comes out all cocky and arrogant, and Backlund gets a few moves to start, and he hightails it to the floor. What was that? You know, like he's just completely shocked that he hasn't already won. Little things like that.
Yeah, Luger the heel for the first 7 months of his run in WWF was pretty good. Or better than pretty good, because the thing is, there's a case of not being miscast. Here's a real egotist. Yeah, he was truly a narcissist. And the nice thing about these eight guys, we were actually treated to a few good matches. Bret Hart, Razor. Well, Bret Hart, this was Bret Hart's, you know, he had already been a world champion. He beat Ric Flair for the WWF title. This was like another, I don't know, enough people watched it. It had a decent buy rate. You could call it a star-making moment, even though WWE business was on the downslide. Dan, why don't you kind of speak to that, this being, you know, this is like Bret Hart's coming out party. This is his way of saying, I can wrestle a lot of good matches against a lot of people.
No, you look at the card, and, you know, he went 10 minutes with Razor, 19 minutes with Kurt Hennig, and 18 minutes with Bam Bam Bigelow, and I don't have any star ratings in front of me, but as I recall, those were all, you know, reasonably good matches. And he, you know, this was, I think this is your next question, but I think this was the right way to go with this King of the Ring, you know, title or whatever you want to call it, because he had been a champion. He was going to be a top contender, probably the top contender to Yokozuna. And, you know, you were getting rid of Hulk Hogan. You need to have a new type of babyface. And if you're really trying to differentiate, why not show that your babyface can really have entertaining matches? So,
good point. Good point. And speaking of Hulk Hogan going on his way out, like I said before, the only other really advertised match we had was Yokozuna versus Hulk Hogan. I guess, you know, neither one of those guys could then be in the tournament. Shawn Michaels was defending his Intercontinental title. I don't know, Dusty, can you kind of speak to that? I mean, Dan was right, I think, right? All the right choices were made here.
Oh, yeah, as far as who wins and loses, absolutely. Bret had three good matches and beat three top names. Razor was on his way up. Mr. Perfect had already established himself. And Bam Bam was a big killer heel, you know. It was a perfect mix, perfect choice of people to beat.
Talk about the booking of the final match, too. We had that false finish type of thing where Luna interfered and Bret was pinned, and then, you know, after some confusion, the referee restarted it. I mean, talk about that as far as booking the final match.
I'll tell you, my friend Nick and I were so excited when we thought Bam Bam won, you know. Yeah, they're going to let a heel win. Yes. And you're like, oh, no. Sit down, you dumb marks. That ain't happening.
Nice.
But, you know, it made Bam Bam look good. You know, you can get away with that every now and then. I wouldn't see that as a negative.
Sure.
It certainly was better than a Dusty finish because at least they had the good guy win, you know, and you didn't leave feeling empty, you know?
Right. Well, another thing it did was something, you know, it goes toward something, Dan, you said. It helped tell the story of Bret Hart. You know, he'd worked basically, what, 43 minutes on this show, which is four times longer than Hulk Hogan would have worked, you know, over the course of the night, and he overcame adversity. He's the smaller guy, so of course the bigger guy who got a bye earlier in the show is going to beat him up a lot. He already was beaten up, but he's tenacious enough to come back and win this first ever King of the Ring, this prestigious belt, or, you know, whatever title, crown, whatever you want to call it. And then Jerry Lawler comes around and that final segment was fantastic. And it was short too, really. I mean, I looked it up on YouTube the other day. I think the whole thing took maybe like 2.5 or 3 minutes or something like that.
Yeah.
They're running out of satellite time.
Yeah, but sometimes that's fine. Less can be more because, I mean, Jerry Law, and I sent at least you, or I'm trying to think, I think I sent you the video where he explains his actions on Memphis TV, which is just, again, the brilliance of of Jerry Lawler in terms of being able to cut a promo where he can be such a heel in the WWF and then explain very rationally why, as the king, he would be offended that they would be, you know, giving away his title that belonged to him, and these guys were just fighting for some phony king title in his mind.
And yeah. Dusty, we could do an hour show alone on Jerry Lawler. We could do a 5-hour show on Jerry Lawler.
I really think he is the best wrestler ever for a multitude of reasons.
Yeah.
Just such an awesome worker, and I really felt like genuine passion during that last part there where he attacked Brett. That was really well done. And as Dan said, just amazing that they could pull it off where he's a heel and a babyface at the same time.
And if you watch those things on YouTube, to watch the Bret Hart and the Owen Hart, and Bret particularly, the heel interviews he's doing in response, I mean, it's good stuff. And they didn't really worry about blurring the lines. They just figured, well, these people in Memphis are going to cheer for Lawler anyway, and most of them did, so they went with it.
Right. Mm-hmm. And not to out this person, and hopefully nobody in charge of anything is actually listening to this show. Let's see. Pop Culture Stew?
I think that's right.
So if you go to YouTube and search for Pop Culture Stew, STU, you'll see all sorts of awesome uploads, particularly from the CWA in Memphis.
Yeah,
and when it's the USWA.
As I said, I think that Memphis stuff kind of flies under the radar because I don't think anyone really knows who owns it. So it doesn't get pulled from YouTube quite as quickly as a lot of other stuff.
Yeah, especially when it gets
stuff getting pulled. Soli's gone. Soli Wrestling.
That sucks.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yep.
Yeah. So many good YouTube posters. And then there's Matt Hardy.
his stuff doesn't get pulled. What the fuck?
Yeah, why not?
Let's see. Dusty, King of the Ring 93. Overall thoughts. Thumbs up, down in the middle as far as the inaugural pay-per-view.
I definitely give it a thumbs up. You had three great performances by Bret Hart. You had Hulk Hogan losing. Can't beat that. overall a very good show.
Dan?
Anybody else think you could have done a little more convincing job on the way out? I mean, that would be kind of
They should have just literally set him on fire.
I mean, he picked the guy who he was willing to lose to, and then he kind of put him over, I don't know, in a... I mean, that's just typical Hulk Hogan. He's never been my favorite, so.
He might as well not have even fucking shown up. And Jericho should have just beat somebody else. I mean, for God's sake.
A camera blowing up in his face. A camera shooting a fireball. Good one, Hogan. Asshole.
But a very good card overall, I would agree.